This is The Way of Conquest, a Star Wars prequel trilogy, The Mandalorian, The Clone Wars era fanfic, written by Pagination and read by Rena Jenkins. The story is rated G and is gen, with additional tags for major character death, time travel fix it, immigrants, we get the job done. Summary. All Din wanted to do was find the child a sorcerer teacher, pick up a job or two, and follow his creed. 3 out of 3 is good, right? Right? Inspired by What Do You Mean, Time Travel? By Black Victor Kachat and Master Quester. Author's notes at the end of each chapter. Chapter 1. Din Djarin versus Supreme Chancellor Palpatine. Being in the Jedi Senate pod gives Mace hives. He's briefly grateful he keeps his head shaved. At least nobody in the Senate will realize that politicians make him shed, which was the reason he started shaving to begin with. If he had any hair left to make a statement with, it'd probably be standing on end anyway. Emergency powers. The pounding shatterpoint headache makes him wonder just how well the Chancellor will stand up to giving them up when it comes time. But that's a problem for tomorrow's Mace. Today's Mace is wondering why the criff he's wasting time at this senatorial theater when he could be getting the teams ready for Geonosis. He can't even release his feelings into the Force. It's been almost unendurable for the last 7 days, like it's been holding its breath before a galactic-sized sneeze. Mace would very much like to go somewhere and whack things with his lightsaber. Patience, says Yoda, who's always counseling patience right up until he doesn't feel like being patient himself. Important it is for Master of the Jedi Order to be present. Both the Master and the Grandmaster might be considered overkill. Dangerous time this is. Much fear in the Senate there is. Solidarity we must show for the future of the Republic. Mace would like to shove Jedi solidarity up the Senate's collective ass. He doesn't, because he is a Jedi Master. He is peace. He is dignity. Some days he wishes he really had run away from the temple as a kid and become an actor. If nothing else, he could have gotten away with saying criff it a lot. Nowadays, he just has to emote it. With peace and dignity, it's not as satisfying. Criff it. The voting has started on the emergency powers motion. Even without the pod display, it's obvious that the motion will carry. Mace runs an idle hand over his freshly shaved scalp. Clone armies. Republic armies made of clones. Armies they still haven't figured out the origins of. This is the kind of bullshit that Jedi are supposed to stop. And here he is, tacitly advocating their use. Obviously, things are criffed up right now. He sees no prospect of it getting better anytime soon. Especially given this particular situation has Obi-Wan Kenobi, Chaos Monkey, wedged deep in its colon. Another problem for tomorrow's Mace. His calm chirps with a message. He sighs and straightens. Fisto's reported in. His team is wrapping up their mission and will be free to meet us on Geonosis. Yoda hums to himself, maybe in approval, and turns his attention to the Chancellor's podium. In the time Mace took to read Kit's message, the Count had finished. The Chancellor is gravely responding to the passing of the motion, promising to create a grand army of the Republic. Create. Huh, Mace thinks, as the Senate bursts into applause, wondering why the Shatterpoint hasn't passed with the counting of the vote. He can feel it poised, just waiting to crash over him. Curious, says Yoda, his ears twitching in a way that Mace knows from sad experience means something awful is about to take place. Ah, criff, Mace says, suddenly feeling it too. He clutches for his lightsaber. It is at this point that three things happen. One, the terrible tension in the Force bursts across the Force-sensitives of Coruscant in a deafening roar. Two, the Shatterpoint hovering over Mace cracks across his vision, whiting it out in a lightning strike of agony. Three, a rift pops open directly above the Chancellor's podium. It's small and black, invisible against the stronger light that bathes the Chancellor's seat. It lasts for all of a human eye blink before disappearing again, one of billions that happen every second around the vast reaches of space and time. Mace flails for the railing of the Senate pod, dimly able to make out Yoda clutching his own head. Through a tear-filled squint, Mace just barely makes out a flash high up in the dimness of the Senate chamber. Light glares off a falling object, sharp and silver. Metal crashes into the center of the Chancellor's podium, right on top of the man. Palpatine and Slymore go down. Masameda, hit by a glancing blow, spins and smacks hard against the side before he, too, collapses. The Force cackles like a horrible goose. Mace staggers again. He is pretty sure his skull has actually turned inside out, and his brains are now splattered across the Jedi pod floor. That's too bad. All he can see is light. Light, white, and blinding. Quite an accomplishment when his eyes are squeezed shut, but that's what he gets for letting his brain splat around outside of his head. The Force yanks at him, excited. The applause of the Senate has given way to stunned silence, even as Mace clutches his lightsaber and hurls himself blindly off the edge of the pod. Yoda is a supernova behind him. The light is... the light... flaring through the Senate as the dark that has choked Coruscant for so long suddenly shreds. Even as he wrestles with his headache and the demands of the Force, Mace puts together some pieces and really dislikes his split-second conclusion. The Mandalorian in viscera-smeared Beskar gets to their feet right about the time Mace lands on the edge of the Chancellor's podium. Blood is everywhere. So are other things that belong on the inside of a body instead of the outside. Mace squints down his lightsaber at the Mandalorian, who's looking down at Palpatine's face with a quizzical tilt of their helmet. Palpatine's very dead face. There's no medical intervention in the known galaxy that can put that together again. You're under arrest for the murder of Supreme Chancellor Palpatine, Mace says, a sinking feeling in his chest.
Huh,
says the Mandalorian. The Senate chooses this point to start screaming. I want him dead, shrieks Masameda from his stretcher. If that's not representative of the Vice Chancellor's breathtaking respect for the rule of law, Captain Inspector Coble Antilles thinks sourly. He can't imagine what is. He envies Master Windu's cold composure.
His isn't anywhere near as good, though at least his face is disciplined enough to prevent him being fired on the spot. It's his experience and reputation that's brought in as lead CSF investigator on the death of Chancellor Palpatine, not his fondness for the man or his cronies. Not that his personal feelings would influence his professionalism. He sighs quietly to himself and answers the question that prompted the Vice Chancellor's venom to begin with. He's currently installed in a secure room in the Senate, under guard. A few quick commands in the nearby terminal brings the feed up for the Security Committee and the Jedi in the conference chamber. The Mandalorian, in freshly cleaned armor, sits quietly in a chair in the room. At the moment, they appear to be poking about in their bag. They're still in their armor, Master Windu says neutrally. They are, Koble says, and adds before the Vice Chancellor can complain, and also armed, though they gave up their blasters, rifle, and knives at our request. They have been very reasonable. Unlike several of the people in this room, he carefully doesn't say. They identified as strict follower of Orthodox Mandalorian traditional practices. As they haven't been charged, we are following regulations to respect their beliefs with regards to armor and identity in not exposing their face.
Also so with name, Senator Uriba chitters shrewdly.
They've requested we refer to them as Mando.
I want him stripped of his armor, identified and thrown in prison immediately for the murder of my dear friend and predecessor, Chancellor Palpatine.
Masa made a hissed, pushing himself up, only to sink back down again with a groan.
He will be sentenced and executed for treason.
You mean tried for treason, Vice Chancellor,
Master Windu says.
I have emergency powers. If I say it's treason, it is treason.
Emergency powers to Chancellor belong. Promotion of you to Chancellor missed, I must have,
Master Yoda says, his beady eyes narrowing.
In the event of the Chancellor's death, the Vice Chancellor takes the position until the new election can be done, interposes Senator Ornfrita smoothly.
Every time Koble so much as looks at the Senator, he has to forcibly keep himself from reaching for his blaster. He and his colleagues have all found too many cases dead-ended in the powerful hands of Ornfrita and his friends to have any fondness for the corpulent Twi'lek. Conscious of Master Windu's attention shifting to him, and even more conscious of the Jedi reputation for mind-reading, something Koble is well aware is not just a rumor, he suppresses his murderous instincts and equally vicious satisfaction, to say deliberately. Under normal circumstances, that would be correct. Senator Uriba's mandibles twitch in obvious satisfaction. She is, as Koble well knows, not a political ally of Masa Maeda and his bloc, and was the one to privately clue Koble in on certain legal realities several hours before the meeting.
This not normal is circumstance.
Of course not. It's not every day that the Supreme Chancellor is murdered by traitors in front of the entire Senate, says Senator Ornfrita, with a creditable expression of grief. My poor dear friend.
It is an outrage, cries Masa Maeda. I will have the entire Coruscant Security Force replaced for their incompetence.
Koble ignores him to say firmly,
as you say, Senator, the entire Senate. Which means, according to the Articles of Succession, Section 238, Subsection 141.99,
across the table, Master Windu flinches, closing his eyes, and raises a hand to his temple.
That the rule of conquest has come into effect. The slayer of the Chancellor before a registered plenum of the Senate
thereby gains the title until such time as formal elections can be held. Which, per the emergency powers granted to the Chancellor just before Palpatine's death, can only be scheduled by the Chancellor. Excuse me, Chancellor Mando. He's never seen that particular expression on so many politicians' faces at one time. He instantly saves it in his memories as his new happy place.
That's...
Ornfritas sputters.
That's undemocratic!
Maza Meda shrieks. Cobble eyes the man who's been running around the Senate drumming up support for Palpatine's emergency powers for the last 2 weeks, and gives in to temptation. Surely the galaxy owes him this one. In such dangerous times, he says smoothly, repeating verbatim Masameda's own words before the emergency powers vote. We need a single voice, a firm hand. A leader to guide the faltering ship of the Republic. We cannot stand divided in the face of anarchy. The room descends into chaos. Despite his own discomfort at the idea of the Republic being run by a Mandalorian mercenary, there's a significant part of Cobble pointing out that there are worse candidates for leadership in a time of war than an actual warrior. There are two glaring examples of said worst candidates in the room with him right now, in fact. Idle daydreams of what a mercenary unused to politics would do in response to Maza Meda and Ornfrita's language allows Cobble to listen to their vitriol with equanimity. Master Windu has sunk into a chair to cradle his head in his hands. Headache, he decides. Or some kind of Jedi Force bullshit. Master Yoda's ears are doing something bizarre. Senator Yoriba and Senator Groshuk from Kashyyyk, on the other hand, seem to be enjoying themselves to an excessive degree. On the security feed, a tiny Master Yoda crawls out of the Mandalorian's bag and is carefully lifted to sit on top of his lap. Once there, the tiny Master Yoda immediately tries to eat one of the Mandalorian's grenades. It is unfairly cute. The argument is growing increasingly vicious by the sounds of it. Cobble is hoping that if the Wookiee snaps and kills everyone, he'll start with Ornfrita, so he can have the satisfaction of watching that before he gets his own head ripped off. Under all the noise, his comm chirps. He checks it. It's one of the Senate Guard assigned to the Mandalorian.
Mando asking for live frogs.
Cobble waits for a moment, expecting a correction. Instead, he gets the amendment.
Frog slash fish eggs, also good. Please advise.
Gloomily certain he's going to regret this, Cobble sends back. What for?
Baby Mando eat.
Well, that answers at least one question Cobble never had about Master Yoda's species. The Senate Commissary is, by nature of its patrons, perfectly situated to provide for the Mandalorian's needs. Cobble sends a quick catering request to the kitchens, charmed by the unquestioning acknowledgement he gets back.
Griff, he needs to sleep.
He eyes the shouting politicians. Senator Groshuk has gotten into things now. He looks like he's enjoying himself, as much as a Wookiee can outside of ripping slavers' arms off. The Jedi don't look like they're planning on doing anything about it. This meeting is never going to end. Cobble sends a quick order to the security team to have the Mandalorian escorted up. Nobody is paying any attention to him. With a casual tap, he turns off the security feed. Vice-Chancellor Ameda's histrionics are a perfect cover for him to mumble excuses and step out for the quieter atmosphere of the hall outside. The few minutes it takes for the Mandalorian to arrive are almost enough time for Kobol to calm himself down and start second-guessing himself. Watching the armored warrior stalk up the hallway toward him, flanked by Senate guards and with child tucked safely away in their bag, is an exercise in proactive intimidation. Kobol mutters a curse behind his hand.
What the criff is he thinking? Really?
And steps forward to meet him. I'm somewhat familiar with your people from dealing with the Bounty Hunters Guild, Kobol says without preamble. So I have to ask you now, what's your creed? Mando comes to a halt. His bag chirps, the flap opening just far enough for a pair of enormous dark eyes to peer out at Kobol.
Oh, come on! That's just not fair!
With a determined effort, he keeps his gaze firmly on Mando. Obviously, caring for your child is part of it, which means you're not Death Watch, Kobol prompts.
Children are the future. This is the way.
Mando's oddly quiet voice responds. It sounds significant. Kobol has no criffin clue what that significance might be. He scrubs at his face.
At this point, he would happily trade his left nut for some sleep.
Fine. What else? Honor, adherence to a contract, duty to the tribe. I'm fairly certain you're not a new Mandalorian, given the armor.
It's curious how emotive the faceless armor can be.
Kobol reads the small head tilt as confusion. After a moment, Mando says,
Yes.
Yes to what? Another pause.
Honor. Adherence to contract. Duty to tribe.
Perfect. Fine. That's already a significant improvement over the other candidates.
Kobol huffs out a breath. According to the rules, it looks pretty likely that you'll be the Supreme Chancellor of the Republic in a few hours, he says bluntly. Rules of conquest. You kill the old Chancellor in front of the entire Senate. It's a ruse and reformation rule, something to do with possible Sith infiltration of High Command. He gestures his bafflement of the whole business. It doesn't matter.
Another cautious silence.
What does a Supreme Chancellor do?
Now there's a damn good question. With a Criffin emergency powers, an argument could be made that the Supreme Chancellor is the closest thing to a king the Republic could have. Keep the Republic from falling? He probably shouldn't have phrased that as a question.
Mando does a creditable impression of a statue, while his child pokes his entire head out to stare at Kobol. It is offensively adorable.
We can write up a bounty contract, Kobol says a bit desperately. It could be considered a bodyguard assignment.
Mando looks down at the child.
The child peers back up at him.
And as the new chancellor under a rules of conquest, you couldn't be arrested or charged with the death of the previous one.
Mando and the child look back at him.
It pays well, Kobol thinks to add.
Huh,
says Mando. The Senate emerges from emergency lockdown 16 hours after the death of Supreme Chancellor Sheev Palpatine in a special emergency plenary session. It's the second in the last full cycle. Despite being a mandatory session, several pods remain empty. Notably, for those paying attention, those belonging to Outer Rim worlds that have been vocal in their discontent. Very few people are paying attention. After the Chancellor podium rises into the light, the gleaming figure of the fully armed and armored Mandalorian standing front and center, even fewer people are paying attention. Once the Speaker of the Senate makes his announcement, absolutely nobody anywhere is paying any attention to anything else at all. And then, of course, Sly Moore, Palpatine's chief of staff, attempts to attack the newly sworn-in Supreme Chancellor. It goes poorly for her. Very poorly. The Hollanis have the best day ever. Best day ever. Author's notes. Scenes that didn't make it into the chapter. Nameless Chief Commander of the Coruscant Security Force, NCC-CSF. The Chancellor has been murdered. Whoever gets this job is going to get so much scrutiny. Nobody is going to be happy. His career will end up toast no matter what he does. Nameless Chief Commander of the Coruscant Security Force's second in command, 2IC. We can't assign anyone who's actually useful to us, or politically important, or related to anyone politically important. NCC-CSF. We can assign someone who's more trouble than he's worth, someone who's inconvenient to us. 2IC. Someone professional, though. We don't want him to make us look bad. He'll have to actually do a good job before he gets screwed by the Senate. NCC-CSF. Someone who's competent, inconvenient to us, and expendable. 2IC. Someone with a reputation. NCC-CSF. Someone we both hate. Kobol. Kark. Senator Uriba. Palpatine dead is. This great day for Republic is. Senator Grashuk. He went splat. That was very enjoyable. Senator Uriba. Masameda will become new chancellor. This terrible day for Republic is. Senator Grashuk.
I can make him also go splat.
Senator Uriba.
Wait, my friend. Cunning plan I have.
Senator Grashuk.
Better yet, I can make him go rip.
Kobol. So you're the guy who killed the Chancellor. Din.
Who?
Kobol. You want to take off your helmet? Din.
No.
Kobol. How about a name? Din.
Call me Mando.
Kobol. That's a noun. Sure. How about a proper noun? Din.
What's a noun?
Kobol. Kobol. Yeah, okay, whatever. You want a wet wipe? Din.
Acceptable.
Kobol. What made you kill the Chancellor? Din.
Gravity.
Kobol. Well, that's super helpful. Din.
Old people in the Corps have weak spines?
Kobol. There's also the part where he exploded like a water balloon filled with internal organs. Din.
Old people in the Corps are also soft.
Kobol. That's a very specific qualifier. In the Corps. Are old people different in the Outer Rim? Din.
Yes.
Cool.
What would happen if you fell on an old person in the Outer Rim?
Din, thinking of the armorer.
They would beat you to death with their hammer.
Cobol.
Have another wet wipe.
Chapter 2. Din Djarin versus his cabinet. Dooku is just emerging from another fruitless conversation with his stubborn Grand Padawan when he feels the burst of hilarity from the next corridor. The Force has been bizarrely confused of late. It's the first time he's managed to sense anything coherent in the last 20 hours. For that reason alone, he goes to investigate. He finds Jango Fett in a control room. Helmet off, leaning on a console and staring at a holonews feed. The screen shows the Senate Dome of Coruscant and a flood of legislators making their way out of the building, many of them looking dazed or agitated.
"I take it that news of our movement has finally reached the Senate?"
Dooku asks, composed over his surprise. The emergency powers motion has taken almost a full Coruscanti cycle longer to pass than Darth Sidious predicted. Though the timing is still within the expected tolerance, it's been irritating having to delay the others in their declaration of secession. Fett's attention doesn't waver from the screen, though he turns the volume up so Dooku can hear. The broadcaster is speaking about Mandalore's Senator Wren and how they're lodging strong protests about the...
What?
Dooku is briefly frozen in horror. It's long enough for the holonews to switch to a recording of the Chancellor's Senate pod. Chancellor Palpatine and Mas Ameda are conspicuous in their absence. Instead, the pod contains a fully armored Mandalorian being attacked by a pale Umbaran. Dooku recognizes one of Palpatine's advisors a split second before the Mandalorian headbutts her right off the pod. New Supreme Chancellor Mando opens position in cabinet, reads the scrolling feed.
Jango Fett is laughing. Dooku hadn't realized he knew how.
Supreme Chancellor Mando,
the man says, with a manic glee that chills Dooku to his bones.
Finally, the Republic is about to get what it deserves.
Din is having a curfing day.
This, says Cobol, is the Chancellor's office. Your office, that is. Chancellor.
The office is enormous. The Razor Crest could have fit in this space with room to spare. Massive windows on the far side of the desk show a vast cityscape, gleaming under a dark night sky. The floor sinks under his feet. Thick carpets that mute sound. This might be the richest place he's ever seen.
It's awful.
Din has never had an office before. He isn't sure how to feel about it. Grogu squirms in his arms, attempting to get down.
Not until it's safe,
Din tells him. The child promptly flops over his arm, convinced it's the end of the world. While Cobol rattles off about the security both within and without the room, Din does his own security checks. His HUD spies several cameras and recording devices, some better hidden than others. There's at least one well-concealed door set behind a tapestry that leads to a secured exit in case of emergency. There's also a secure bolt hole in case of invasion. It's stocked with bottles of liquor. Cute. The Senate guard has a watch on all entrances, and there's a driver standing by for a getaway if there's ever any threat. Cobol explains, nodding to some of the blue-armored security who have positioned themselves around the room.
They've been side-eyeing Din all day.
Hmm.
Din says. Don't mind them. You're a proven threat to the Senate they're supposed to guard, while being the Supreme Chancellor they're also supposed to guard. It's causing them existential heartburn. They'll get over it.
I can do my own guarding.
Eh. Cobol shrugs. As an afterthought, he adds, they'll be guarding your child, too. A little backup never hurts. For whatever it's worth, no chancellor has ever been betrayed by a blue guard in the history of the Republic. That means absolutely nothing to Din. The new Republic is 5 years old. Besides, he's learned through hard experience that just because something hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. Yesterday, for instance, he'd never randomly teleported from a temple on Yavin into a Senate pod on Coruscant before. Today, he has. Never say never. Still, the room is secure enough, and he's confident enough that he can take out any guard that makes a move on Grogu before they can do any damage. He lets his kid down. Grogu immediately runs straight for the desk, only to fall flat on his face 2 steps in. Cobol bites off an adoring sound and just manages to abort his move to go to the rescue. In the past few hours, Din's new employer has increasingly lost his stiffness until he started to talk like a normal person. The man reminds him of a crankier Cobb Vanth. Grogu even likes him. Din will need to keep the lawman close. He's the most rational being Din has met here so far. There's chambers for the Chancellor to stay in if you're tired, Cobol says, when Grogu's popped up again to start running in a completely different direction. There's no surveillance in the bedroom, so you can take off your helmet. The blue guard can show you the way. They haven't had a chance to clear the rooms out yet, unfortunately.
I don't mind.
Din has slept in much worse than another being's sheets. And there are aides and a variety of people lining up to talk to you outside, I'm guessing. The guard will let them in when I leave.
What do you want me to say to them?
I don't know. Whatever comes naturally, I guess. I am going off shift. I was already near the end of a double when you made your dramatic entrance. Kark, I'm tired. I might be hallucinating. Cobol pauses long enough to squint blearily at Din. Din looks back at him. I'll come back after I grab some sleep, Cobol decides. Din nods a bit blankly. Grogu is trying to climb the chair set behind the desk, mostly by hanging from its edge while it gently spins in a circle. Since the kid appears to think this is the best thing to have ever happened to him, Din leaves him to it. The next couple of hours are frustrating and confusing. The contract Din agreed to with Cobol was clear. He is bodyguarding the Republic. The Republic, that is, defined as, quote, the constitution and needs of the member planets of the Republic, end quote. It's not the strangest bodyguard that Din has ever taken before. There's a surprisingly active market involving hits or protection for abstracts like reputation and virtue. But Cobol had promised there'd be lots of people to help on this job. People with experience in republicking. Unfortunately, Din comes to realize in the first hour, most of the people who are supposed to help don't have the sense the Kara gave a rock. There's a bunch of aides who rush around asking him silly questions about his wardrobe and trying to take holos of him holding pens. Weird. There's a beat-up, sleazy Shagrian Din vaguely recognizes who acts like Din carked as Tuka but owns his debts. Annoying. There's a group of senators called the Loyalist Committee, who can't seem to decide if they want to strangle him or roll up in a ball and cry. Useless. And then there are the strange monk people, who include the one who arrested him earlier. Jin has no idea what's up with the monk people. They're acting like they expect him to start frothing at the mouth and bite their legs off without warning. They're not scared, exactly. Just wary. All except the one Kildor monk, who keeps trying to peer around the edge of the desk. Grogu's under the desk. Din keeps the monk at bay with the power of his glare. He doesn't see the one he thought might be one of Grogu's species, which is a pity. That, at least, would have made this conversation interesting.
So you're in a war?
Din asks at last, cutting through the spiraling arguments. He's not surprised the New Republic is at war after only 5 years of being in charge. It just seems a little ambitious, is all. He thought they were still cleaning up from taking over. No, says a bearded human senator. Horrors, says the fat Twi'lek, who apparently leads this gaggle of senators. Yes, says the Shagran. The bald monk closes his eyes too long for a blink. Master Obi-Wan Kenobi recently gathered proof that the Separatists have purchased an army. It's on Geonosis. Unfortunately, he was captured. At the previous Chancellor's behest, we've gathered an assault team to rescue him and retrieve the evidence.
An assault team?
Din asks, his professional interest caught. Yes, Chancellor. We have over 300 Jedi responding to the call. Jedi. Jedi? Over 300 Jedi? He found over 300 Jedi when Din had to run around the galaxy just to find one? The monk is a super Jedi finder. Din is impressed. And yet he wants to send them off to Geonosis, where none of them can teach his kid. All of them? For an extraction? Din silently judges the bald monk man and finds him wanting. The Grand Senator, meanwhile, has started shouting about using some other army, one that apparently needs Din to immediately authorize. Half of the other senators disagree. Loudly. There is nothing in the contract with Kobol that indicates army authorization is part of Din's job. Though there's nothing that says it isn't, either. Although, in theory, an army could be useful in large-scale defense, he's learned the hard way that simply throwing bodies at a problem doesn't necessarily make things easier. Witness whatever the cark it is that's happening in this room.
So there is a war,
he interjects, in yet another attempt to establish the facts.
Because you're invading?
Nonsense, sniffs the Shagran. Perhaps uncivilized, aggressive peoples like you armored Mandalorians might consider it an invasion, but it's simply the exercise of justice. Repatriating a brave and noble servant of the Republic with an army, interrupts bearded Senator, from traitors, the Shagran plows on.
Is Geonosis part of the Republic?
Din asks a bit desperately. Because if it isn't, he doesn't have to care about it. Apparently, nobody is sure. More arguing ensues. Grogu, who's building towers using data pads and blaster cartridges, reaches over to pat his leg. Din's temper eases a tiny bit, but not much. He's already on edge. He doesn't know the terrain, and he doesn't know the target. Two things that are guaranteed to make any Baroya dangerous. He's had a pounding headache for the last few hours. Doesn't look like he'll be getting any relief anytime soon. And the carking monks keep staring at him.
If they don't stop that, he's going to throw them out the window.
One of the aides, a quiet blonde bothan that has so far not harassed Din about anything preposterously stupid, quietly slides a new pad onto his desk. He investigates, and discovers with relief that it's loaded with a list of planets and sectors, helpfully titled, Member Planets of the Republic. A number of them on the outer and mid-rim are flagged assorted colors, indicating Separatist or Sympathy for Separation. It's a playlist. Useful. He instantly dubs the aide Helpful Yellow and settles in to learn more about Geonosis.
Desert, irradiated, insectile natives, hives and tunnels. It's apparently a shithole. Feels like home.
With at least some intel in his pocket, he's a tiny bit calmer.
Settled enough to start troubleshooting anyway.
As a bounty hunter, he's learned that it's vital to identify immediate threats. Work your way back to root causes. Remove the motivation. A blaster can still kill you, but taking out the power pack usually means the gun won't fire. If the money disappears, no self-respecting assassin will finish the contract for free.
So the Separatists,
he says, trying to find his way through this mess.
Why are the Separatists a problem?
They're traitors, says the Shakrian.
Because they have an army?
Because they want to leave the Republic.
Is that not allowed?
That's not actually the issue, begins Bearded Senator. The Shakrian looks down his nose at him for his trouble. The Separatists have grievances with the way the Republic treats their needs and distributes its resources. One of the monks, a humanoid of some type, chimes in. They feel that the majority of attention and assistance goes to the core worlds, who have less need of them. They claim Republic corruption has taken more from them than it gives.
Are they right?
Din asks.
It seems early days for corruption in the New Republic, but it's not like they started with a clean slate.
Several of the senators jump in with loud denials and complaints. It's easy to tell that about a third of the senators feel the Separatists have a legitimate complaint, as do all the monks. Din is willing to bet most of the ones that argue against it are denying that corruption exists because they're neck deep in it. Loudness seems to be a qualification for senatoring.
Regardless of how true their grievances are, the fact remains that Master Kenobi reported privately to us and the late Chancellor that the Separatists intended to use that army.
Bald Monkman breaks in at last, overriding the bickering.
The army is an immediate threat. The reason the emergency powers were voted for the Chancellor's office was to allow the Chancellor to command the creation of a Republic army, something that is normally not allowed under the Articles of Constitution.
Din really needs to get a copy of this constitution if he's bodyguarding it. Inconvenient to discover he is apparently violating said constitution just by nature of stepping into the Chancellor's powers, though. Still, root causes. The grievances and corruption are a sarlacc hole he can dive into later.
Who's funding the Separatist army?
The Trade Federation and banking clans. Gron Senator says.
The Trade Federation and banking clans are friends of the Republic, blusters Fat Twi'lek. Why, my very good friend Son Hill just had dinner with me the other night. I'm sure that whatever is happening out on the rim is either rogue bankers or just business.
Whether it's rogue bankers or just business, their credits have paid for the manufacturing of a droid army on Geonosis. Master Kenobi said...
Droid armies?
Din interrupts sharply. Suddenly his path forward is very, very clear.
They have droid armies.
Why is it always criffing droids?
If Obi-Wan could provide evidence to the Senate, that could show the path forward, says Bearded Senator. With leverage, there may still be a diplomatic solution. Bald Monk Man emotes like his entire body is a pair of rolling eyes. Interesting effect. As I mentioned before, we have assault teams ready, he says tightly. Once we have the Chancellor's go-ahead, we can proceed. He looks expectantly at Din, which reminds him that he's the Chancellor now.
Over 300 Jedi, you said.
Yes.
Why?
It's a strange number. Too many for an insertion and extraction. Too small to face an army. Maybe if they were bringing down a single factory, but... no, it's still strange.
I'm sure what the Chancellor means is that it doesn't seem like quite enough Jedi, does it? Says the Shagrian in heavy condescension.
That's not what Din means.
Why 300?
That's how many were available in the time we had, says Bald Monk Man.
That's a terrible answer.
What's the plan exactly?
Why is it necessary to know, Chancellor? The Shagrian demands. It's your role to order the Jedi how to act and delegate the implementation of your decision to them. Din ignores him.
Bald Monk Man says slowly, the plan is to assault Geonosis?
He's getting increasingly tense.
Din waits. But apparently that's it. That's all he's getting.
A full frontal assault?
Yes.
To extract this Master Kenobi, a full frontal assault is your plan.
Yes?
A full frontal assault to save a prisoner on a planet riddled with hives and tunnels and containing a droid army. A full frontal assault with 300 people. 300 sorcerers, true, but still.
Din abruptly realizes that it isn't just that these people are completely confusing. It's that they're also... what was the Alderaanian word Kara explained?
Nincompoops. That's the word.
Some people you just can't help, Mando. They're nincompoops. They speak nincompoop, think nincompoop, and do nincompoop. And there's nothing to be done about it besides take them out of the gene pool if you can.
There's a cultural disconnect happening here between Mandalorian and nincompoopians. Relieved at the realization, he says simply,
no.
Bald Monk Man and his friends immediately bristle. No to what?
No to frontal assault being the entirety of your plan. That's terrible.
They're Jedi, says the Shagrian. You should know from your own people's history, Chancellor, how dangerous even a single Jedi can be.
Do their powers make them immortal?
Bald Monk Man and his fellow monks settle in to regard him thoughtfully. The not-so-subtle tension that rode them since they walked into the room starts to relax for no reason that Din can tell. Setting that aside to consider later, he adds,
a frontal assault of a few hundred against a reported droid army will get them killed and risk the target. A smaller, stealth-based extraction team with a good plan and intel has a higher chance of success. A larger assault team can be on standby for distraction and support if needed.
He judges Bald Monk Man. He judges him hard.
All of the monks look at each other. A couple of them look puzzled. After a moment, one of the monks murmurs at a volume Din only manages to catch parts of because of his helmet.
Producing Jedi casualties in the rescue of...
And then,
this is the path we would have taken originally.
But he's Mandalorian, mutters another.
The Force is clear and concurs,
says the Kel'Dor monk to Bald Monk Man, sounding pleased. Din is very Mandalorian. He isn't sure why the magic needed to verify that, although it's useful to learn that some of the monks are also sorcerers. Maybe that explains their ability to find Jedi? Under the desk, Grogu wobbles to stand and coo up at Din. He offers the kid a couple of fingers and is reduced to a belay line as the kid starts to climb his leg.
Do you even have people capable of this kind of extraction?
He asks, suddenly hopeful. Joining a crew to spring a prisoner would at least have the benefit of familiarity over his current... whatever this is that he's doing in this place. We do, Bald Monk Man says firmly, straightening. He looks peculiarly heartened. We'll send the comms immediately. He rises even as he speaks, and sweeps out, already tapping at his comm. Din reflects that he doesn't really understand why monks are responsible for extraction missions in the New Republic, but Puer used to tell him the Old Republic was a mess and a half. No doubt the New Republic is just following tradition. Tradition is important. Still, this particular tradition seems pretty stupid. Maybe they're martial monks of some sort. They don't even have blasters, which is an argument against it. Well, it's something you'll have to ask Kobol about later. With a sigh small enough not to be caught by the vocorder, he turns his attention to the rest of the gaggle. The senators are back to arguing again. This time about some army somewhere that's apparently just... lying around? Din doesn't have enough context to understand what that's about, so he takes a moment to help Grogu settle on his lap before he asks. On the one hand, it turns out that the kid still derails fights faster than a blaster bolt through the head. Good to know. On the other hand, everybody, including several of the monks, has to make some sound of surprise. And then several of them have to ask loud questions or make rude and snide comments about the kid. All at the same time. Din keeps an eye and an ear on the reactions. Bearded Senator immediately rises in his estimation, as does one of the suspiciously off female Twi'lek aides of Fat Twi'lek. Din knows a slave when he sees one. And most of the monks. All of them visibly soften at Grogu in a genuine way that proves they have excellent taste. Kel'Dor Monk goes so far as to twiddle his fingers in a wave at Grogu, who squeaks excitedly and waves back with both hands. Din makes note of those whose reactions are more negative. He'll be keeping an eye on them. Is this your son? Asks Bearded Senator, smiling.
Yes.
He's lovely, Bearded Senator says, not probing further despite his obvious curiosity. Din's opinion of him inches up a tiny bit more.
Greetings, young one,
says Kel'Dor Monk. The smile is audible in his voice. Grogu squeals and leaps at him. Dank Ferrick! Din's too tired, too slow, but Kel'Dor Monk has excellent reflexes and catches him easily. Grogu chortles, patting at the monk's mask with little clicks of his claws against the metal. Din's hand maybe twitches toward his holster. The smile is even warmer in Kel'Dor Monk's amused.
Peace, young one. You have alarmed your parent.
While Grogu makes little sounds and apparently holds a conversation with Keldor Monk, Din wrestles down the usual complicated mess of protective wrath, fear the kid will want to leave him, determination to let him go if it'd really be better for him, and worry that he's screwed something up completely if the kid is so eager to go.
Ah,
says Keldor Monk warmly.
I believe you. I'm sure he is the very best parent anywhere.
Sharply, Din asks,
you can understand him? You have the magic?
He ignores the Shagrian snorting over magic.
The Force, yes. Your son is determined to tell me all about how strong and good you are.
Grogu chirps happily and reaches out toward him. Din stands and accepts him back with relief, not for the first time thanking Kara for the helmet hiding his blushes. The senator's and Monk's reactions are mixed. Even distracted, Din's not fool enough to miss the glint of avarice in Fat Twi'lek when he looks at Grogu, or the small frown on a couple of the monks. The chagrin, on the other hand, curls his lip.
Perhaps the child would be better off being given to some minders while you work on more important things, Chancellor, he says.
None of these people are his employer. Even if they were, Din wouldn't care. Karkum.
No.
I fear he's distracting you from more important things.
Nothing is more important than the child. This is the way.
The way?
Keldor Monk cuts in, sounding interested.
I apologize, Chancellor. I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with the armored population of your culture. Would you be willing to explain?
It's a politely worded question. Keldor Monk inches up even more for posing it.
Education and armor, self-defense, our tribe, our language. Foundlings are the future. This is the way.
Yes, yes, the Shagrin says dismissively. It may be your way, but it isn't the way of the more civilized Republic. I don't know, Vice Chancellor. If the Republic valued education, self-defense, and the children more, we might not be having a separatist crisis, says bearded senator. The Shagrin sneers. Of course, as you say, Senator. However, Chancellor, this is rather besides the point. Your child is disrupting our work. You have a responsibility to the people. Surely a Mandalorian understands about duty. Din, balancing Grogu on his hip, considers him.
You wish to separate a Mandalorian from their child.
The monks, he distantly registers, have all come to their feet and are moving strategically around the room. Bearded Senator, glancing between them, rises as well.
Ah, it is getting rather late. Perhaps it's time for us to break for an hour?
The staff can arrange for childminders if it's so important to you, the Shagrin says, snapping his fingers at one of the aides and pointing at Grogu in clear command. The female glances fearfully at Din.
I'm afraid I must insist. You'll see how much easier things will be without his demands on your attention.
Looking terrified, the aide inches toward Din, only to freeze when he turns his head slowly to look at her. Smart female. Confident he's made his point, Din directs his next comment to Bearded Senator.
Is he important?
Bearded Senator looks startled at being addressed. Who? Aide Ackerman? Everybody is...
No. Him.
Din tips his head at the Shagrin.
Who is he?
The Shagrian's outrage is utterly uninteresting, Bearded Senator says, confused. That's Masa Maeda, the Vice Chancellor.
Is that important?
He's your second in command, Bearded Senator clarifies. Helpful.
Din thinks for a second, ignoring the Shagrian's continued blustering, then looks at the Keldor monk.
Who do you work for?
Keldor monk says tranquilly.
I serve the Force, but I also serve the Republic.
Common interest, then. Good. Din hands Grogu off to him.
Stay here,
he orders. Then he punches the Shagrian in the stomach. It's a funny thing. He hasn't met many Shagrians. Those he has met in the past have been honorable, by and large. Not martial, as a rule, so generally not people who end up on the business end of his blaster. As a result, he's never actually punched one. This is apparently a day for new experiences. It turns out that Shagrians are just as susceptible to fists to the stomach as most humanoid beings. The man wheezes, slowly collapsing in disbelief. His leathorns clang loudly against Din's pauldron as he goes down. There is an instant sensation from the rest of the gaggle. Variations on, Chancellor, you can't! And, Chancellor, you shouldn't! Rise behind him. Din waits to see if the Shagrian will fight back. Mostly, the Shagrian rolls around and whines, hugging his stomach. He's disappointed at the lack of follow-through. A commitment to the role of second-in-command, or a real ambition to be the leader, might have made for a nice challenge as the Shagrian worked to earn his respect or overthrow him. Certainly the constant challenges, not to mention trying to separate a Mandalorian from his child, suggested the kind of bloody-mindedness that usually resulted in a good fight. But no. Nothing. Pity. Behind him, Grogu coos. There's more clinking as the kid pats Keldor Monk's face. Since none of the people protesting are actively doing anything but flapping their mouths, the Senate Guard looks like they're suffering all the pain of that existential heartburn Koble mentioned earlier. Din waits just long enough to make sure there won't be any vomiting before he hauls the Shagrian up over his shoulders. Helpful yellow catches his eye. That's definitely satisfaction on the aide's face.
Show me the way out,
Din orders. He's yet to actually leave the swamp rat trap. The aide nods hurriedly and scuttles to the wide double doors Din entered by. Din follows. Most of the gaggle trail after him through the labyrinth that is this building, still chattering in dismay or approval. Along the way, they pass doors, almost all of them opening at the noise and disgorging more sentients avid with curiosity. Almost all of them join the parade. A not insignificant number of Senate Guard materialize to bracket him. Din's not convinced they won't stop a blaster bolt to his back, but he has enough faith in his skills and his armor to be fairly confident he can get out of anything they throw at him. Eventually, finally, the aide brings him to an enormous hall. Din thinks it's what's called a rotunda, with multiple doors that open into the night and a long, wide array of stairs down to a paved square. Din nods, satisfied, and dumps the groaning Shagrian. By this time, any reasonable sentient would have long since started to struggle and regain his feet. The Shagrian, proving his incompetence, simply flails onto the step as though being dropped is a surprise, and then falls down the stairs. They're long stairs. Dramatic. Weird choice on his part. It'll take him a while to get down to the bottom that way. Din doesn't have that kind of patience.
You're fired,
he tells the bouncing body, loud enough to be audible even over the Shagrian's shrieking. Then, since he wants to get back to his kid, he turns to stalk back inside. The crowd behind him scrambles to get out of his way. Good. He retraces his path without difficulty, helpful Yellow and a few of the Senate guards scampering to keep up with him. He passes a uniformed Ithorian with a trolley just outside the door and discovers most of the monks still in the office, along with a couple of the senators. Bearded Senator is one of them. Grogu he finds happily playing that ball-floating game with Keldor Monk. The office is blissfully quieter than it was, especially given the gaggle Din managed to outstrip with ease several hallways back. As usual, Grogu greets his appearance with a squeak of delight that warms Din's heart. He just manages to catch his kid's leap into his arms, the ball floating after him like a wobbly satellite.
Did you behave yourself?
He asks. Grogu giggles. The Keldor monk chuckles as well. That means no. Chancellor, greets bearded senator. He is hovering by his chair, looking wary. May I ask what happened to Maz Ameda?
Yes,
Din says.
The Chancellor had no real intent to harm him.
Keldor Monk reassures bearded senator, which makes Din wonder about crazy magic Alsek.
You could tell through your powers?
Those with the Force can read intent, though your Beskar helmet muffles it somewhat.
Keldor Monk shares. Din perks up. That's a useful trick. It explains a few things about Grogu. Can sorcerers tell if...
Sir?
It's the Ithorian. Senate guards are inspecting the staffer and the trolley he's pushing. It's the same kind of trolley they used to bring Grogu his fish eggs earlier. Except whatever this mail is, it'll be significantly bigger given the size of that covered bucket. Grogu recognizes the trolley as well, if the excited flailing and cheers are any indication. At some point, Din reflects, he is going to have to figure out how to get food for himself. He grabbed a ration bar in the fresher earlier, but he could use a real meal.
Let them check it first,
he tells Grogu, just barely managing to keep him from flopping right out of his arms. Hoping to get some answers before that noisy bunch of senators comes back, he turns his visor to the unimpressed-looking bearded senator to ask,
What's this army the Gran wanted to send to Geonosis?
The clone army? Is Din supposed to know? He doesn't know. That's why he was asking. He sighs. Bearded senator's jaw firms. Before we talk about that, sir, we really must speak about your apparent tendency to respond to opposition by attacking people. Din says blankly.
I haven't attacked anybody.
Grogu claps his hands in agreement. Good kid.
What's in the bucket?
Live frogs, sir?
Says the Ithorian, while the Senate guard finishes patting him down and another scans the trolley. Chancellor, you just punched the Vice Chancellor. What?
Oh.
Din realizes belatedly that he should have asked Kobol about Coruscant rules. On the Outer Rim, blunt force impact isn't considered an attack. It's a conversation opener.
That's a problem. I fired him.
He tries to appease. Bearded Senator is not noticeably pacified. You cannot attack the Vice Chancellor in the process of firing him. Employment laws aside. The trolley cleared, the Athorian starts pushing it carefully inside. Which is exactly when the noise that's been growing steadily louder outside reaches a climax, and the entire pack of irritating senators comes storming back into the office. This has predictable results. It's just been that kind of day, Din supposes. Grogu cheers as he's finally let down and immediately dashes off to hunt. If nothing else, the unexpected impact has made the senators freeze and shut up. This might be because Din is half-drawn on them out of pure reflex. The merciful silence is interrupted only by the Athorian's groans and upset sounds. Fat Twi'lek lifts his foot to look at the bottom of his shoe. Din doesn't know why he bothers. He's not going to see it. Was that a frog?
Don't step on my kid.
Din orders the nincompoop brigade, securing his blaster. Chancellor! Wails Fat Twi'lek. Dank Ferrek, he's too tired for this shit.
Bearded Senator, Clone Army, talk.
Bearded Senator blinks, taken aback. Bearded Senate, that's not my... I'm Bail Organa, Chancellor, Senior Senator for Alderaan. Oh. Din straightens, interested.
You all found a new planet?
He should tell Kara.
Good job.
What?
You named it the same, though. Isn't that a little weird?
What?
Is it registered as Alderaan Mark II? Or just Alderaan? Never mind. Tell me about it later. Clone Army now.
Organa clutches at the back of his chair like it's the only thing keeping him standing. The Army, he says weakly. Grogu pounces on a frog that's made it as far as Organa's boot and shoves half of it triumphantly into his mouth. The frog's legs kick. Nearby, the Keldor monk quietly starts to chuckle.
Robert,
says a frog by Din's foot. The data pad in Din's hand cracks in half.
10-year-old Mandalorian clones?
Author's notes. Scenes that didn't make it into the chapter. Senate Aid Office. The new chancellor will need aides. Senate Aid Office. The old chancellor preferred humans, with a few hyper-competent non-humans to show he wasn't speciesist. Senate Aid Office. Even though he totally was. Senate Aid Office. We'll send the new chancellor aides of his own species. That's always safe. Senate Aid Office.
Kark. We don't know what species he is.
Senate Aid Office. Is armor a species? Senate Aid Office. Anybody in the secretarial pool who wants to volunteer to be one of the Chancellor's aides? Risks include being killed, stared at, fired, or disappeared. Senate Aides.
So, not that different from the old Chancellor?
Bothan Aides, who this author headcanons as completely without fucks to give due to a single throwaway line in Star Wars 4 A New Hope.
Yo! We up.
Senate Cafeteria. We just got an order for frogs from the Chancellor's office. Senate Cafeteria.
Kark! How many frogs is enough frogs?
Senate Cafeteria.
Chancellor looks like a big guy. What species even is he? Does he eat his own body weight? Some species eat their own body weight.
Senate Cafeteria.
Kark it. Send him all the frogs.
Chapter 3. Din Djarin versus the first morning on the job. Kobol comes home, kisses his children, takes a sonic, and eats his dinner. He spends 2 hours researching everything he can about Mandalore and Mandalorians, going as far as to pull up old reports involving Mandalorian bounty hunters. His colleague's opinion on the last can be summed up as, "Kark no," which is borne out by various tallies of property and collateral damage. He's too tired to have second thoughts. It's too late for them anyway. But he maybe suffers a qualm or two on reading them. It's remotely possible he wasn't flying with all engines when he decided to enable a coup of the Galactic Republic. He only starts having actual regrets when his wife shucks him out of his home office to wring a play-by-play of his day out of him. Not for the first time, he wishes that his chief rival for the title of Best Investigative Mind in the 3rd Division didn't also happen to be a devastating combination of deviousness, brilliance, and ruthlessness. If she'd been missing any one of those qualities, he might not love her so desperately. "I don't think what you did was treason, technically," she tells him, looking thoughtful. "At best, you hired a protective detail on the victim of a crime, one that required specialized personnel. You've done that before, so there's precedence. All you have to do is file the correct paperwork. It should be well within your budget. Worst case scenario, you could argue you hired a confidential informant as part of a new investigation into Senate corruption. You have to file the CI paperwork to cover the argument, just in case. And pull his pay from the CI budget, of course." Kobol protests. "I can't pay the Chancellor from a budget used for snitches. Kark, it sounds like I'm bribing him." "He could cut the equivalent of the bounty out of the Chancellor's pay and donate it to the same fund. It's just money shuffling. If they tried to spank you for that, they'd have to take down most of the Republic." "And what victim? How would that even work? Palpatine's dead. He doesn't need a bodyguard." "The Republic is the victim, obviously. I'd say the crime was Palpatine's cabinet. I like the work the new Chancellor's put in so far. Mazameda bounced beautifully. I could have watched that all day." Her satisfaction is vicious. His wife is a beautiful, wonderful woman who knows how to hold a grudge. Her short time in the Senate district was exciting for all the wrong reasons. He dutifully finds the correct forms and files them. Mando goes down in the contractor ID field. The Republic goes down as protectee. CSF paperwork is where dreams go to die. Nobody will realize what he's done for at least another decade, when some activist senator on a committee decides to throw their weight around for an audit. Mando had given him a Bounty Hunter Guild account to send his paycheck to, so Kobol sets up the regular transfer for the bodyguard job he'd posted directly. He considers routing the Chancellor's salary as well, but decides to wait until he can check on it with Mando. Come to think of it, he's not sure he mentioned to Mando that the Chancellor job comes with a salary. Just looking at the numbers involved makes him feel renewed loathing for the Senate. Then, since he's done with anything resembling actual thought, he goes to bed. 4 hours later, his calm shrills with the alert of a high-priority message from work. He fumbles it from the bedside table and peers at it with bleary eyes. It's the Blue Guard.
"Priority Alpha, Chancellor Emergency, call in."
Adrenaline and horror washes away even the memory of sleep. He launches out of bed and races to his home office, barely hearing his wife's sleepy complaints. A priority call into the Senate security number has him rerouted immediately. "What?" he snaps to the Blue Guard lieutenant, who answers.
"Captain Inspector Antilles, we need you to come in."
"What's the situation?"
"It's the Chancellor, sir. We need you to intervene."
Kobol, whose imagination has already had time to come up with assassination attempts, explosions, kidnappings, the Mandalorian he hired murdering the Blue Guard because they touched his kid, clutches the edge of the desk. He was dragged from deep sleep without warning after a solid 72 hours without. He currently has no chill whatsoever. Intervene in what? The lieutenant hesitates.
He's...
He winces. Looks to the side as though hoping for support from a colleague. Then he refocuses, finishing lamely.
Doing something weird.
Coble stares blankly at the man. Then he looks at the clock running in the corner of the screen. He drags his hand down his face. Flatly, he says, "You're calling me in the middle of the night because the new chancellor is doing something weird." Says the lieutenant.
"It's actually his kid."
"Are you carking kidding me right now?" The lieutenant opens his mouth. Then he closes it. He holds up a finger to ask for a moment. Some hasty typing later, a small window opens in the holocall, a security feed into what looks like a very expensive living room. It's the Chancellor's living room, if the armored figure standing in the center of it is any indication. And... "Huh," Coble says.
"See?"
All the furniture in the room. Sofas, tables, chairs, statues, decorative screens. Is... floating. Floating and moving to stack up against the wall. No, against a door set into the wall. It's a defensive barricade preventing any access in or out. If he squints, he can just make out the little green mushroom of Mando's kid standing near him. "What's that door that's being blocked?"
"The bedrooms and the guest treasures. There's an office back there as well."
Coble scrubs his face again. The adrenaline is fading, leaving exhaustion and chills in its wake. His heartbeat is slowing. "So the Chancellor's redecorating. What exactly did you want me to do about this?"
"You're friends with the Chancellor. He likes you. He lets you talk to him. You could talk to him!"
"What?"
"He talks back to you. When we asked, he just looked at us. We don't know what's going on,"
the lieutenant wails. An unfortunate reality of the Blue Guard is that its officers' ranks are riddled with the children of politicians. Offspring who have decided, for whatever reason, that law enforcement would be fun for a while. While some prove to be more competent than the origins might suggest, the inevitable incompetence are usually mitigated by relegating them to positions where they can do little damage. Positions like designing dress uniform regulations, protecting the Senate dome from visiting school children, watching the security monitors of empty residential suites. Coble desperately wants to go back to sleep. He's just about to tell this dipshit lieutenant to man up and do his fucking job when the last piece of furniture settles on top of the now enormous barricade. The kid plops face down onto the carpet and stays there. Mando looks down at him. Then he unholsters his blaster and turns to stalk off camera. The lieutenant whimpers.
"Is he coming to kill us?"
"Oh, for Kirk's sake." Coble quietly dies inside. He sighs.
I'll be right there.
Deepa Balaba hasn't felt this excited to go to the Senate since she was an initiate visiting for the first time. It's a novel sensation. It's one that the other masters she's joining on this trip share. Terra Sanube's force presence bubbles with quiet anticipation. Plo Koon's radiates eagerness. Even Jocasta Nu's force presence, usually strictly ordered and disciplined, is sharp with curiosity. Deepa has learned to enjoy such moments as they come, so she makes little effort to hide her own excitement from her fellow Jedi. Even Jocasta's determined debrief on the Jedi's catastrophic failures in Mandalorian relations in the last 20 years doesn't quite quell the thrill. By rights, he should have tried to shoot Master Windu and Master Yoda in the face, Jocasta says grimly on the ride to the Senate Dome.
And yet, I rather like him,
says Plo, slowing the speeder as they reach a cordoned crowd of protesters and media.
I found him to be an even-tempered and shockingly rational man. Curious, isn't it?
Massacre at Galadron. A civil war in the power vacuum left behind. Jedi support of the new Mandalorians. Subsequent banishment of traditionalists by the new Mandalorians. And now, a traditionalist Mandalorian chancellor. Disastrous for the Jedi Order, in theory. Deepa, whose own encounters with Mandalorian bounty hunters should have thoroughly quashed her childhood conviction that Mandalorians were cool, but didn't, tucks her hands into her sleeves and doesn't squirm with excitement. A familiar blue guard is waiting for them as their speeder pulls up before the Senate Dome, his helmet off and a feeling of frustrated relief bleeding into the Force despite his outward calm.
Master's Jedi, he greets.
He gestures to another guard to take the speeder. They're wanted urgently, then.
If you'll come this way.
This kind of reception is usually a hallmark of galactic crises. And yet, the Force feels just as delighted as it's been the last 2 days. In fact, it feels enthusiastic. Exchanging glances with her companions, Deepa falls into step behind the guard.
No Master Yoda today? The guard asks.
Not today. He's tending to business in the temple. Said business being his inability to stop giggling. Many of the eldest in the temple have been similarly struck by unexpected force hypersensitivity. Several others have simply slipped away into the Force with a relieved smile on their faces, as though the swift disillusion of the dark released them from a heavy burden. It's been an oddly sad and joyous time of late.
I hope nothing is amiss, Captain. More than to be expected, given the circumstances, that is.
Plo asks kindly.
You saw the crowds coming in?
They do seem agitated.
Agitated is a word for it. We've been fending off journalists and drone cameras for days. They haven't been this bad since the Margoshi scandal broke.
The Holonews has replayed captured footage of Masa Meda's firing endlessly since the previous evening, along with commentary from political experts. Was Masa Meda's firing in such a way legal?
Yes, though the Chancellor is opening himself up to lawsuits, but not criminal charges, curiously enough.
Was this yet another demonstration of the new Chancellor's murderous Mandalorian tendencies?
A spokesperson from the new Mandalorian government protested any association with traditionalist barbarism.
What could have prompted Masa Meda's dismissal?
Do not attempt to come between the Chancellor and his son,
Plo warned before they left.
He is appropriately protective.
Was there merit in long-standing rumors of the Vice-Chancellor's corruption?
You'd be sadly unsurprised about the things I suspect about that man, but could never prove,
murmured Terra.
That's two cabinet members who have been dismissed with violence. Who will be next? And how will he dispense with them?
Do you know, I caught several knights placing bets,
Tara said, amused. Deepa notices with interest that they're being guided in a direction slightly separate from the Chancellor's office. It's a route she's never taken before. The Senate halls are crowded even at this early hour, the group of Jedi gleaning the usual looks of interest and alarm. Close though the Senate is to the temple, Jedi are increasingly rare visitors to these halls. She frowns at a sudden realization. She's had this thought before. For the first time, it occurs to her to wonder why. The captain takes them through several layers of security, each increasingly thorough, until they finally enter a quieter, slightly less grandiose portion of the building.
Residential quarters lie this way,
he tells them, nodding to several guards as he passes.
The Chancellor has personal chambers here for occasions when they aren't able to go to their own residence. Captain Inspector Cobble Antilles asked that you be brought here when you arrived.
They don't have a chance to ask why a CSF investigator would be in the position of directing the disposition of the Chancellor's visitors. Two Blue Guard open a pair of doors, and they find themselves in a large, beautifully appointed receiving room. Even without being told, Deepa can recognize Chancellor Palpatine's influence on the decor. Understated but luxurious, a Nabooian aesthetic that serves to emphasize to the sentient it is expected to frame. Though oddly barren of furniture, save for a low table and a set of decorative screens blocking off the back of the room, it's a room meant for statesmen and nobility, for powerful political figures poised in pretended ease. Against this backdrop, the actual people present are a jarring note. Captain Inspector Antilles, identifiable by his rumpled uniform, is trying to drown himself in caff. The new Chancellor, in full armor, is seated on a breathtakingly expensive wood table. He is trying to convince his child to eat a spoonful of what looks like pond scum. The Chancellor's child, meanwhile, is trying to feed his father some kind of squirming worm. Through the helmet. Deepa holds her breath to keep from cooing. Plo had warned her, but her imagination had boggled at the conjunction of Yoda and the word cute. The reality is almost upsetting.
Finally,
Captain Inspector Antilles mutters, when greetings and introductions have been offered and Captain Bentashi has bowed out.
Masters,
he squints at them, apparently recognizes Master Sanube, and says with relief,
Oh, it's you.
Cobble,
Tara smiles and bows.
It's been a while. I'm surprised to see you here.
Antilles mutters something indecipherable, clutching his calf, then sighs. Blue Guard called me in last night to deal with the situation. Yes, because of you,
he adds in the Chancellor's direction, though it's directed more at the child. Said child's ears perk up inquisitively.
I hope you're happy.
The man sounds and feels more fondly resigned than truly irritated. The child yawns, only to meep indignantly when the Chancellor takes advantage of the open mouth to pop his spoon in. Pond scum sprays all over the Chancellor's helmet. He sighs, shoulders slumping. The child shoves his worm in his mouth with a distinct air of triumph.
Is there an ongoing investigation I should tactfully avoid asking about?
Tara asks. Another mutter from Antilles, this one completely lost inside his calf. Outside of his mug, he articulates clearly,
No. Case closed on the transition of power.
It's just that some people, the Chancellor, obviously, who is cleaning himself off with apparent indifference to the conversation, need to learn to use their words instead of acting like they'll be fined by the syllable, so that other people can get a decent night's sleep. Whatever Antilles' role is in the new administration, it's plainly one that affords him significant freedom. His casual familiarity with the Chancellor has a curiously humanizing effect on the Mandalorian.
I use words,
the Chancellor says. Deepa registers the quiet weight of his voice, the care and hint of reluctance with which he uses it. Use more of them. The Chancellor's shoulders hitch in the tiniest of shrugs, just as a new worm from the bowl beside him smacks into the side of his head. The child looks innocent. The Chancellor sighs, quiet fondness eddying around him. I'm glad you're here, although I have to ask, why are you here? Antilles directs back to Terra. I thought you were an investigator.
The Force called me to come here today. And yes, I'm still an investigator,
Terra says serenely.
Investigating what?
I don't know yet. I'm sure the Force will provide.
Antilles rolls his eyes. Deepa can't help but find his lack of dignity charming, especially compared to the composure practiced by the standard Senate Dome denizens. The Chancellor, who has apparently given up on feeding his child anything not still squirming, looks up at this point to stare at Plo. While his emotions are difficult to read through the Beskar and the small supernova that is his son, Deepa can pick up the certainty of his intent. There isn't even a hint of hostility at the Jedi standing in his living room. Unexpected. Wonderful. Baffling.
Kamino?
The Chancellor asks.
Master Shaak Ti and the others arrived just before we left the temple to come here.
Plo says, folding his hands serenely, as though he wasn't just engaged in wiggling them at the child.
She'll be reporting in as soon as she's made a preliminary review of the situation. With your permission, we will accept her report here.
The Chancellor nods.
Geonosis?
Master Windu is en route to meet with support teams, Deepa reports. He should be arriving within the hour.
Plan?
Better than the original one,
Plo promises.
We have several shadows in the area. Unfortunately, we learned a few hours ago that the Senator of Naboo and the Padawan guarding her were also captured by the Geonosians.
Padawan?
Seriously?
Antilles says. The Chancellor looks at him. Antilles sighs gustily.
More words, Mando! Do you want to know what a Padawan is? Who the Padawan is? Why a Padawan was assigned to guard the Senator? What?
After a brief pause, the Chancellor simply says,
Yes.
Are you criffing with me right now?
The Chancellor stares unreadably at him. With a squinted glare, Antilles slowly and deliberately slurps a mouthful of calf. Quiet amusement shivers across the Force. Plo, more warmly, supplies.
A Padawan is a Jedi learner, one who has been claimed by a Jedi Master. In this case, Master Obi-Wan Kenobi, to be taught the ways of the Jedi on the path towards knighthood. Master Kenobi's Padawan was assigned to protect Senator Amidala from assassination attempts, while his master investigated the reasons behind the attempt.
Which led him to Kamino,
Terra supplies. And the discovery that someone has been sabotaging the Jedi archives, Jocasta adds grimly. The Chancellor says,
Huh.
Then he says unexpectedly,
Master Kenobi is a Jedi?
Deepa exchanges glances with her fellow Jedi, feeling their shared surprise.
Yes?
Says Plo.
Our apologies. Were you not aware?
With sudden caution, he adds,
We are all Jedi.
The Chancellor considers Plo for a long moment. Deepa tenses, feeling the spark of alarm from her companions. If he was not aware they were Jedi, it would explain his lack of animosity so far, confusing as it was. But now that he knows... He stands to scoop up his child and balance him on his hip. His visor turns toward Antilles.
What?
Antilles asks, defensively clutching his mug.
They're Jedi,
says the Chancellor. Cautiously, Deepa focuses her senses on him. That earlier certainty hasn't changed, though now it's tinged with... confusion?
I thought you knew. They're carrying lightsabers.
By way of demonstration, Deepa cautiously unhooks her own lightsaber and shows it to the Chancellor, unlit. Jocasta and Plo do the same in their turn, though Terra simply hums, nodding down to his hip where his hangs.
Lightsabers aren't just used by the Jedi.
The Chancellor objects.
They're almost always used by the Jedi. A couple have shown up here and there when we do raids, usually as a collectum's item or a trophy.
Antilles cuts an apologetic glance at Terra, who nods sadly.
But only Jedi really use them.
To use a lightsaber is difficult, and almost impossible if one isn't Force-sensitive,
Terra supplies. The Chancellor's confusion grows, if anything. And there's still no hostility.
Are you sure?
Words, Mando! Antilles sighs. What are you thinking?
The Chancellor visibly pauses to consider. Then he turns to Plo. There's a distinct sense of the subject being changed.
The child needs a teacher for his powers.
Plo's Force presence pulses with delight. He's very predictable. Deepa smothers her amusement along with her astonishment. A non-hostile, traditional Mandalorian Chancellor who actively asks Jedi to train his Force-sensitive son. Master Windu is right. The man is a unicorn. Your child is quite powerful, Jocasta says, her eyes narrowing. You will not send him to join the Jedi?
He decided against it for now. He had a teacher before.
The child, busily floating worms from his bowl to his mouth, squeaks up at him. He glances down at his son and gently rubs his head, getting a sweet purr in reply. The Force brightens with his child's love.
The child decided to return to me rather than stay with him. But you can come here.
We can.
Plo hesitates, a hint of caution entering his body language. There are many other Force traditions in the galaxy. Many of them are harmless. Many of them are... not so harmless.
Who was his previous teacher? Someone we might know?
Skywalker.
Surprise pings through the Force, bouncing between them.
Anakin Skywalker?
Plo asks.
Master Kenobi's Padawan.
The Chancellor tilts his head.
Luke Skywalker.
He corrects, as though they should know better.
The last Jedi.
They can hear the capital letters in the title. The last Jedi on your planet? Deepa asks, even though she knows quite well there are no other Skywalkers in the Order.
The Last Jedi in the Galaxy.
This, Deepa supposes distantly, is what Master Windu meant when he said talking to the Chancellor was like taking repeated rancors to the head. Deepa hadn't been able to reconcile unicorn and rancors to the head into one being before, but now she understands. Under the sudden headache-inducing clang of the Force, she can faintly hear Antilles coughing. Some calf gone down the wrong way.
"Oh, dear," says Tara. "Did he tell you he was the last Jedi? There are occasionally pretenders."
Even through the helmet, it's obvious that the Chancellor is giving him a skeptical look.
"Everybody calls him that."
"Locally?"
"Galactic news feeds. I looked him up. He killed Darth Vader and the Emperor."
Darth Vader is not a name Deepa has ever heard. Emperor recalls shades of Sith empires and history lessons. And yet, the Force resonates with his words. Deep, mournful peals of true, true, true. "Darth Vader, a Sith," Jocasta says sharply. "Is that the master they've been searching for, whose apprentice Obi-Wan killed on Naboo?"
"What emperor?"
The Chancellor looks between them.
"Emperor of the Galactic Empire?"
he says slowly.
"You speak truth. The Force confirms it,"
Plo says, sounding stunned. "But how can it be true? They can't call it a lie. The Force is overwhelming in its message. Truth." "How is this possible?" Deepa protests.
"What?"
Antilles wheezes. The Chancellor says,
"Good job coming back from extinction."
He looks over at the coughing Antilles as if for approval. His shoulders sag. He turns back to add awkwardly,
"Keep up the good work."
The end. Author's notes. Scenes that didn't make it into the chapter. Grogu blocks off the sithiness of past Chancellor Sith so it can't get to Best Dad. Din.
"My child is securing the perimeter. He is the best child. He will be the best Mandalorian."
Blue Guard.
"Sir, what's happening right now?"
Din.
"That sounds like a stupid question."
Grogu. "Tired. I'm a nap now." Din.
"I will guard the front door."
Blue Guard.
"Sir, by guard the front door, do you mean kill us all?"
Din.
"That sounds like another stupid question."
Blue Guard.
Sir, he's going to kill us all."
Kobol.
"Mando, are you going to kill them all?"
Din.
"Why do your people keep asking stupid questions?"
Kobol to Blue Guard.
"There, see? You'll be fine. Just don't touch his kid or threaten him."
Blue Guard.
"Sir, I don't suppose you'd be interested in writing us a Mando to Basic Translation Guide?"
Kobol. "No." Kobol.
"Look, Mando, you're going to have to use more words. I know this sounds weird, but people used to working with politicians get nervous when you use less than 20 words where only one will do."
Din.
You understand me just fine.
Cobble. That's because I'm not a moron. Cobble. Oh, incidentally, Bluebird wants me to talk to you about that thing yesterday where you punched Omega and threw him down the stairs. Listen, I understand the urge. Din waits. Cobble. That's all I got. Blueguard. That's not what we wanted you to say! Cobble. Keep up the good work, Mando. Din.
Understood.
Reader's notes. I read this on my lunch break, and I knew from approximately 3 paragraphs in the line about the Force as a horrible goose. That's when I decided I had to record the thing. I had to. I could not let that live unrecorded. So great and incredible thank yous to Pagination for having blanket permission to podfic. Let me finish my workday, come home, and just do the thing. I attempted to do vaguely different narrationing for each character's POV, whether or not it worked. Fuck it, at least I'm recording something. I haven't done that in a while. I had great and exciting fun with sound effects for all the different Star Wars voices. I am also a strong proponent of the Din Djarin does not know enough about deep history because it's not relevant to his life story type thing, whatever. I think this is beautiful. I also love the idea that he thinks he's just like transposed in space and everyone else is like, you have been transposed in time. And he's like, well, the core is enough of a fucked up mess that like, this would not surprise me that the New Republic is like this because they're building on the foundation of the Old Republic. Sounds legit. I will bodyguard a concept. Feel free to poke me if Pagination ever writes more of this. It is in fact marked as complete, but it also seems like this might be the kind of fic where if you feel like you come back to it 6 months later with a little bit, please poke me if that happens. I would like to continue recording this, and I will probably not remember to check myself. But yes, Pagination, thank you so much for writing what you did, because the Force wheezes like a horrible goose, and the Force cackles like a horrible goose. So sorry. And it just, such a beautiful image for me. I love it so much. All 3 of these chapters were just like the most beautiful, glorious, cracktastic time travel fix-it shenanigans of my heart. Every Jedi who's just like, Yoda plus baby equals cute? How? Blue screen? Just, Deepa, you are all of us. So, yeah. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Pagination for having blanket permission to podfic. I think I said it a couple times. Let's cover my gratefulness. And I hope you enjoyed it. Have a nice day.